Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I am the founder of Mixergy, home of the ambitious upstart. Today's interview is a bit different from my usual, so I want to start off by telling you why this conversation is so important to listen to and why I wanted to have this interview on. See, think about the first 1,000 people that you got to your site and how tough that was to get just 1,000 hits. How about the first 4,000 or the first 10,000? Well, those are just hits on a web page. Today's guest got tens of thousands of people to leave their homes and to come out to a festival. And I wanted to find out how he did it. I wanted to find out how he got those people to pay, how he got those people to come, and frankly, how he even was able to put together an event for them to come to. Again, that's so much harder than just putting together a web page. Anyone can do it, but a festival, that's something on a bigger scale, and I want to learn how he did it so that we can all bring back some of his ideas to our tech startups. The guest name is Tom Russell. He is a co-founder of Founders Entertainment, which produces the Governor's Ball Festival. That's a three-day multi-stage music festival on Randall's Island in New York City. Tom, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
How many people have come to the festival?
The first year we had 18,000. The second year we had 15,000 each day, and it was a two-day event. And then last year we had 40,000 each day, and it was a three-day event.
40,000. Free event, indeed. Or are they paying?
No, it was paid. Everything is paid.
What are the ticket prices?
For this year's event, it is $230 plus fees for a three-day event. And last year was the same.
Congratulations. And
thank you.
As I was telling you before, for me to get a guest is pretty tough on here, or for the audience to get a customer is pretty tough, or an investor. But there are a lot of customers for us. There are a lot of investors. When you're going after musicians, the kinds of musicians you want, it's a pretty small pool, right? So I'm impressed by how you did it. Can you give the names of some of the performers who've performed, obviously, at the festival?
Sure. We've had Kanye West, Kings of Leon, Beck, Fiona Apple, Guns N' Roses. This year we'll have The Strokes and Skrillex and Phoenix. Outkast, Jack White, the list goes on and on. We've had close to 200 acts play our festival over the years.
And that's part of what I want to learn from you, how you can court them, how you can make a deal with them, how you can get them to show up when there's so many other options for them. But let's understand where you got started. You looked at yourself at one point in your life and said, if I'm going to start a business, it's got to be now. Where were you at that point in your life?
So I was working for a company called Superfly Productions. Mm-hmm. They do the Bonnaroo Music and Arts Festival and the Outside Lands Music and Arts Festival. And I started working for them in college. I went to college in Tulane, in New Orleans. And I worked for them for 6 years until I got to a point where I had hit my ceiling. I wasn't learning anything else. And I wasn't being invited to those closed-door meetings where the really important decisions were being made. And I didn't have a voice in those important decisions. And I decided now was the time for me to leave and start my own venture. I'm not married. I wasn't married at the time. I didn't have any kids. I didn't have too much money. I didn't have too much to lose. So I figured if there was a time to give it a shot, it was then.
How old were you at the time?
I was 26.
26. And you were kind of in the music and business space since you were a kid. In fact, you tried taking up bass, right?
I did, but I'm a very impatient person by nature. Probably something I get from being a New York City kid born and raised. I didn't have the patience to suck for a long period of time before you actually become good. So I opted to go the quote-unquote easier route of going to business school. And, learning as much as I could there and then seeing what I could do on the ground with various live music companies.
All right. So you realize there's a ceiling working at Superfly. It's time to go out there and take a risk and start your own business. What is the first step that you take to building something so big?
Well, the first thing my partners and I realized was that we didn't want to give our notices at our respective jobs before having an opportunity that we could jump on, mm-hmm. and a good opportunity and a reliable one. So during the last few months of our jobs, we set the sort of motions in place to launch this festival. I was taking meetings with folks from the city of New York and with production companies to make sure that we could get a permit for a new event, making sure that we can get all the vendors lined up. My business partner, Jordan, was taking meetings with booking agents, telling them about this new festival we wanted to launch, making sure that we can get the talent. And our third partner, Yoni, was putting together a marketing plan and a sponsorship strategy so that we could really hit the ground running come January 1st. So once we had all of those pieces in play and we knew that we could get certain bands, we knew that we had a permit, we knew that we had certain vendors locked, we told our bosses at the time that we were going a different direction. And then starting on January 1st, 2011, we hit the ground running and put all the pieces together and announced our festival in about 6 weeks.
You mean announced that the festival was going to launch in 6 weeks?
No, we announced the festival in mid-February, and we announced the festival, the lineup, the tickets, and everything. It was everything in one announce.
I see. Gotcha. If I were to make a checklist of everything that needed to happen before you can do that, before you can make the announcement, it's you needed the talent, you needed people to go up on stage, mm-hmm. you needed the permit so that you'd have a space to do it. What else did you need?
Money.
Okay.
So that's obviously the crucial part. We essentially went out to family and friends and offered them an investment opportunity. And we presented them with a business plan that described the market and how there was a void in the market for a music festival. We described the target talent and how those acts were kind of a rising stock, if you will. They were all coming off of sold-out concerts in the market. They hadn't played in a while. The demand was there. We talked about our experience. And we put together this really sound business plan. And then we went out to family and friends, and we offered them three different classes of investments. Each class varied based upon level of risk and reward. It was a waterfall structure of investment. Really going to parents and cousins and friends, we grouped together the necessary amount of capital, which is close to $1 million, to pull this thing off. Luckily, our business plan was correct. And we were very
profitable. Where does $1 million go? Whoa. I didn't realize it took so much to put this together. Where does $1 million go to when it comes to the first event?
About half goes to talent and about half goes to production. So the cash flow process of the music industry is an interesting one because you have to pay deposits up front and then you have to pay a whole lot of cash at the very end. And you're relying on ticket sales to kind of, make sure you have enough money at the very end to pay all the bills. But it goes quick, let me tell you.
By production, you mean things like the speakers, the stage, the Correct. Security, the,
Permits,
the space.
Police.
Did you have to pay for the space? You found an opportunity with Governor's Island, right?
We did. We had a relationship with the company that worked on Governor's Island. And because of their close relationship with the island and the folks that run the island, we were able to get a permit in a really quick amount of time. And we were able to get the land to use for the event for a really reasonable rate. At that time, the city of New York was putting a lot of emphasis on Governor's Island and trying to advertise it as not only a place for family entertainment, but also for concerts and arts and culture. And the event that we were trying to do fit within that category. So they gave us a little bit of a break in terms of rent. We were able to do our event in their biggest, most wide open space.
Governor's Island is that little island right down to the south of Manhattan, right?
Correct.
As a kid, I used to dream of living on that island or one of the other islands because it's so close to Manhattan that you get the views and you get the close proximity, but hopefully you wouldn't have to pay as much and it'd be kind of cool.
The only problem is there are no roads there. So it restricted us from staying there for year two and beyond.
And there's no, what is it called? The trail, the tram?
The tram, yeah, there's
they
no
don't
tram.
They have that right. either. How do you get nope. it on and off it?
You can only go by ferry, which made year one very expensive because we had to pay for not only all of the patrons to take a ferry there and back, but we had to pay for all of the production and the artists to take a ferry there and back.
Wow.
And ferries are very, very expensive. And not only that, but operationally, it's very challenging. If there was, God forbid, an emergency, and we had to evacuate the island, it would be very, very tough. So we weren't able to grow our event to the size and scope that we wanted to on that island because of that. So we had to make a change in year two to another venue that could handle the size and scope of the event that we had always wanted to create.
Tom, did you have an issue of the chicken and the egg problem where the talent wouldn't show up unless you had the production facilities, and the production facilities wouldn't show up unless you had the talent and all that? Or was it just if you had the money and you had the space, people would show up?
Well, you know, being a concert and festival promoter is a very high-risk, high-reward game, if you will. From the artist's perspective, they want to make sure they get paid, and they want to make sure they get paid well. New York City, for better or for worse, is every single artist's best market. It's also one of the most high-profile places they'll play in the world. So for a band to trust a new festival to be their exclusive New York City player, they have to have a lot of trust. So that's where not only money, but also our reputations, really helped us.
You know, the reputations from working at Superfly.
From working at Superfly, from my business partner, Jordan, working at ICM and Paradigm, the talent agencies, folks that we were telling about this event, they had some doubts, but they saw that we were real people from real companies with real experience. Talking with us, they knew that we had our head in our shoulders. They knew the money was real because we paid them on time. They also recognized that there was a void in the market. They recognized that they were having their bands being on something that was special and new. And they were betting on the festival. Lucky for them and for us, it worked.
This is so hard for a new interviewer like me to get top guests, or a new interview like I was. I'm now at about 1,000 interviews, so it's easier. But it is hard when you're getting started. It is hard to get that marquee customer when you're building a web app. And here you were able to do it just because of your past reputation was, because there's so many other people who worked in this space who would have been turned down. What was it about the way that you communicated your experience that made these acts and other people who you're working with comfortable and trust you?
Well, you have to rely on your resume and the relationships that you have. So much of this business, and frankly, any business, is relationships. So, for my job at Superfly, I met a ton of great people in the production world, and I had forged good relationships with various officials around the country. I relied on that to give us some legitimacy. My partner Jordan worked with bands ranging from the Black Keys to Neil Young to the Strokes to Regina Spektor. So, everybody knew that we were the real deal. You have to just rely on those relationships. And everybody did background checks. Everybody made phone calls to make sure we were the real deal. And when you work for really professional, successful companies, it's a good sign. How many times a day do you hear about a new company, whether it's a tech company or not, that was started by somebody who used to formerly work at Apple or used to formerly work at, Blackstone or wherever? People learn as much as they can from the best in the business, and then they carve their own path.
So what about the way that you maintain those relationships? See, you and I got connected here to do this interview, but you spoke to two other people at the company. You spoke to April Dykeman, who did the pre-interview with you. You spoke with Anne-Marie via email, who said Andrew's email from last night was a little nuts. He must have been up really late. But they both had interactions with you, and here I am having an interaction with you. Chances are we'll never get to talk to you again. I'd like to find a way to keep not just you in my network, but all the other guests who I've interviewed in my network. And I bet that Anne-Marie and April would like to do the same thing. But it's kind of weird if all we do is email you and say, hey, Tom, last year you were on Mixergy. How are things going now? Then we're kind of becoming pen pals. So I guess what I'm trying to come back to is, how do you maintain relationships with people who you've worked with who you don't necessarily have any more ongoing work with?
I guess the goal is to leave such a strong impression on someone or a company where they want to keep in touch with you. And when you email them, they want to email you back. We like to pride ourselves on being some of the most fun guys in the business to work with. We like to have a good time. We like to do things in an utmost professional manner. And when people recognize that and they experience that, they want to keep in touch. If you have a great time hanging out with somebody, whether it's for business or pleasure, when they reach out to you again, you're going to remember that great time.
What do you mean? What kind of great time have you had with people? I imagine in the music business, you must have such great times that you probably can't tell me about half of them. But give me like the most fun one that you can talk about.
there's a lot of ego in this business, and there's a lot of people who think they're too cool for school. I would say that we don't qualify in that category. Honestly, we don't give a shit about that. We just want to put on a really good, memorable rock show and make sure everybody has fun doing it. From the security guards who are guarding the stages, to the artists who are playing on the stages, to the patrons in the front row, the patrons in the back row.
So
we just want to make sure people have a good time.
So I worked on Wall Street for a little bit, and I would hear these crazy stories of what people would do together, and these are bonding experiences. Like, one guy drove on the sidewalk in Manhattan and then got pulled over, and his brother was a cop, and so he got out of it. Now, the other people in that car are always going to remember the crazy time they had with the guy who drove on the sidewalk, you know, in Manhattan. Do you have anything like that, any kind of experience like that?
Not really, no. I don't have very many crazy stories in the industry, if you will. I mean, we try to be very, very professional. We just like to have a lot of fun, you know. We keep things very lighthearted, but we're very professional. And the things that people remember most, and, you know, one of the things that get people to trust you the most is doing your job and doing your job well. You know, a lot of these artists are trusting you with their reputation and with their talents. And if you take care of them and you put them on a platform to reach thousands of new fans, they'll remember that and they'll respect that. So, yeah.
If you really want to party down, I could introduce you to a guy on Wall Street. His name is Paul Cervera. I worked for him. He works at a headhunter. I mean, he is a headhunter. And so he has all the stories. Apparently, the rock stars are not having as much fun as the Wall Street guys.
You know, that doesn't surprise me.
Yes.
Two, I grew up reading books about the music industry from the, you know, 60s, 70s, and 80s. And first of all, I don't know how they were successful during the amount of partying that they were doing. But, you know, it's people definitely party. People definitely do crazy shit. People have fun. That's not necessarily our MO. We're pretty business-oriented. But, you know, we're lighthearted. We're good guys. We're nice people. We like to do it well and then have fun while doing it.
Who was the first big name guest that you got to sign on that made you say, this is happening?
Probably Kanye West.
Oh, yeah.
Probably because he was, at that point in time, the biggest act that we had ever procured. He was certainly the most expensive. And he is he is a superstar. You know, and to be honest, I'm not a big Kanye West fan. You know, I like a different style of hip hop, but he is a star and he is a true artist. And we knew that once we got him to sign on board for the festival, that it would launch us to a new level of music festival. You know, he's a major prominent figure in our time.
So Tom, how do you get, by the way, something, did your screen just go dark?
No, it's the light in here. It's a green oriented building. So
do you want to shake your hands up in the air or something like that?
I got to go over there if you want me to do that. I'm happy to do it though.
Yeah, go for it. And then I'll ask my follow up question. While you do that, I'm going to tell the audience that this interview is sponsored by...
Nailed it.
I was going to give the audience my sponsor. I'll do it right now. This interview is sponsored by Scott Edward Walker of Walker Corporate Law. I've said it. Past guests have said it. If you're starting a new business, especially a startup in the tech space, you want a lawyer who understands where you're going in the future, where your funding is going to come from and how you need to be set up for that, where your sales are going to come from, who you're going to exit to, and how to set you up for all those steps along the way. If you're just starting out, talk to Scott. He will help you get started, right? If you're a little bit further along, he's going to help you set yourself up for success at those later stages, acquisitions, biz dev, selling your company, and so much more. He is the entrepreneur's lawyer. To find out about him, just go to walkercorporatelaw.com. Let me say it again because I say things very quickly and I need to give my sponsor proper attention. Walkercorporatelaw.com. So Kanye West could perform on his own and sell out a stadium, right? He could sell out Madison Square Garden. Why does he need to work a festival with other people?
You know, he is playing a music festival is a really interesting opportunity because it allows artists to play in front of a large amount of people that aren't necessarily fans of his. It puts his name and his music in front of you know, fans of lots of other bands. So it gives him an opportunity to get new fans. And also it gives him an opportunity to play in front of the most amount of people possible in this market. You know, he could go to the Garden and play in front of 18,000 people. He could go to Barclays and play in front of 17,000 people. Or you can go to the Governor's Ball and play in front of 40,000 people. So if you want to have the most impact and the most amount of people, you play a music festival.
Gotcha. All right. So you get him on board. You know things are going well for you. What's the big challenge? It feels like then everything comes together, that the city of New York is helping you with location, that you've got the music acts, you've got the $1 million in funding from friends and family. Where's the big early challenge?
You know, there's just a lot of hiccups that pop up along the way in every aspect of the business. Whether it's an artist who has crazy requests and you have to make it happen or not make it happen, whether it's the city that has new regulations or new folks who need certain things met in a certain amount of time, things just pop up and it usually catches you by surprise. And it's how you react to them and respond to them and get through them that really make or break you. We had a pretty bad rainstorm this year in 2013 that resulted in ankle-deep mud. Everybody who came to the event can surely remember the insane amount of mud. And we had a tropical storm that came through on Friday, and it dumped 6 inches of rain onto the property and mud everywhere. And that resulted in a lot of challenges with getting around, and it resulted in city officials and parks officials, you know, very concerned about what to do. Do they cancel the event? Do they not? How does it get repaired? Who's responsible for the bill? You know, safety was a primary concern. There was a lot of things that just kind of came out of nowhere that we had to address and address immediately.
So how do you address the safety issue? That's a legitimate concern. People are going to be in mud. They're going. Sure. It's going to create more chaos. And you have to reassure the city before you even know for yourself how things are going to turn out. What do you say?
Sure. Well, it really comes down to planning. Before the event, we had a very complex, very intricate emergency management plan that addressed everything from severe weather to terrorist attacks to, you know, assaults to really any sort of scenario that could happen at any sort of event. And there was protocol for what to do in each scenario. Our severe weather protocol was we had a meteorologist who was on site starting a week out of the festival. And about 5 days out, they noticed this tropical storm that was actually first a hurricane, then it was reduced to a tropical storm that was headed toward us. And it became evident that we were definitely going to get hit with a certain amount of rain. And we knew just based upon our experience that it would result in a lot of mud. So we huddled up with the city and the Parks Department to make sure that we had ample amount of materials to cover the grounds to lessen the negative impacts of the mud. So everything from wood chips to plywood to hay, you know, creating walkways so that folks could get around, additional security, additional medical. We did everything that our emergency management plan stated to create an environment that was as safe as possible considering the circumstances. So,
God, I got to tell you, Tom, for me, the emergency backup is an iPhone that allows tethering in case the internet in the office goes down. I can't imagine having to do all that. Do you ever look at these tech millionaires who just pop up overnight and go, that is so much easier?
I mean, I don't know if it's so much easier. It's just different. You know, I imagine, and everybody's different, but so many of these tech millionaires spend hundreds and thousands of hours working on their idea and their startup. And it's the same way for us. We spend hundreds of thousands of hours, you know, working on this gig, and things get challenging, you know? And, you know, my worst nightmare, which is that tropical storm last year, can be compared to a startup losing their funding, you know, almost going bankrupt or going bankrupt. It's everybody has their different, you know, doomsday scenario, but it's how you address that scenario and how you persevere that kind of defines you and shows whether you're a success or not.
All right, so we got an understanding of where the idea came from, how you got the location, how you got the talent. How about the way that you got thousands of people for that first event when you had no reputation? How did you get them to come out? How did you even get them to understand that this event was going on?
Well, a couple of things. First and foremost, you get people to come to your event by having talent. You know, you get people to come to your website by having good content. You need to know what people want. For us, since we're all really, really big music fans, we know who people want to see. We know that folks want to see a certain act. We know that that act hasn't played the market in a certain amount of time. We know that their web presence is incredibly strong and their fan base is incredibly, social media driven. We know these things just being music fans and having our ears to the ground. You give people what they want, whether it's
you get Kanye West, people are showing up just for him.
I don't know if you've seen the movie Wayne's World 2, but it's one of our favorites and it inspires us daily. But, Wayne in that movie said, it's in one thing that really hits home, which is if you book them, they will come. So we know which bands to book, and we're confident that if we book them and we can get them, the people will come.
You know what? It is the same thing, at least for me in my interviews, that if I book Tim Ferriss, for example, I know a certain number of people are going to come. If I book Seth Godin the way that I did when I first started out, I know his fans are going to discover him because he doesn't even have to tweet. They're such rabid followers of his work that they'll find him. I see. But you also needed to do some marketing. How much money did you spend on marketing?
The first year we had a $50,000 marketing budget, which was next to nothing. We didn't really know how much we'd have to spend on marketing. We just put that as an earmark. We didn't have to spend anything beyond that, because the sales were there and because we were able to do a good amount of barter and trade. So, people wanted to come to the event. We didn't want to spend more money on marketing. So we did a ticket trade where, we could trade, $10,000 worth of tickets for $10,000 worth of marketing.
Where?
It depends. So, different ad networks, blog networks, I forget the name of a few of them now because it was a few years back, but Complex Media was one of them. Spin Media was another one. See and Hear. We were able to go to these networks and say, hey, we know you want to come to the event. We know you have a lot of clients that you can treat to this event. We're just looking for eyeballs. And we're looking for exposure. So, we'll give you an equal amount in tickets and experience as you can give us in marketing dollars. Let's do a deal. And thankfully, they were into it. And that's why we were able to get away with such a small marketing budget in year one.
Oh, wow. Now, that sounds easy, but it's not as easy as it sounds. Because, yes, they want the tickets. Yes, they're going to give you a certain dollar amount. But there's some spots that cost $10,000 but are really not worth that much, and others that are worth even more. How were you able to figure out which ad spots you want from these guys who are essentially giving it to you for no cash, and which ones are the wrong ones?
Well, we knew, looking at our Google Analytics, we knew where a lot of our traffic was coming from. We took out ads on some of these sites, and we saw what their clicks were like. We know who our target audience is and was. Mm-hmm. So we knew that they were frequenting. We knew, on one hand, we knew where music fans were going. We know music fans were going to music sites, and we were covering that with our marketing budget. But we also knew that music fans also go to lifestyle sites, and they go to sites to read about fashion and sports and art, entertainment. So how do we hit the kind of casual music fan? How do we hit the other folks and make them aware of the event? And we did the barter, and we saw the clicks were second to none. We had a strong gauge of, which type of ads performed the best based upon our experience at our previous jobs, whether it was a leaderboard or whatnot, or a site takeover. And we just relied on that knowledge and the analytics to really choose the most effective route.
I see Pitchfork.com, for example, was very effective for you for sending traffic over.
Yes.
Why Pitchfork? I mean, I understand that it's a music site. I understand. I think they even covered the first year. They did Kanye West site list and all kinds of stuff. But what's the deal with Pitchfork?
They have such a massive, massive base when it comes to music fans. People really trust their opinion. If they post about something, whether it's an album review or an event or a news story, people trust them. They are curators of good content, if you will. When they post something, you're going to get a lot of clicks from it, and especially if it's from an editorial perspective. So, you have a site that evolves around music, you have a site that evolves around good content where their base really trusts their opinion. So that combination of music lovers and that trust is going to result in people wanting to learn more about whatever Pitchfork's writing about.
What did you learn about how to pitch media about an event?
You know, it's a tough question because we have to compete with so many other events out there. It's gotten a lot easier over the years as we've gotten bigger. You know, really, media wants to cover our event if they like the talent that we have. So in year one, it was pretty tough. Year two, a little bit easier. Year three, very easy because we had huge bands and we were the first major music festival to hit the New York City market since All Points West. And our lineup was vastly bigger than All Points West. And then this year, we're just riding the wave from last year. We have an equal size lineup. We have bands that haven't played the market in over 8 years that are huge. We have a lot of New York City bands. And we've really become known as the New York City event. So, you know, you combine good music and a good event with the biggest media market in the world, and you're going to get attention. So it's gotten easier.
When you did spend money, it was largely on Facebook, Google, YouTube. How did that go for you?
It went great. You know, as time goes by, so many more marketing budgets are going away from TV and radio and print and going toward digital. You know, we spend about 90% of our marketing budget on digital. Through YouTube, through Facebook, through Google, we are very hands-on with our marketing and we analyze analytics on a daily basis.
So what was most effective?
The YouTube ads, for sure.
YouTube. Yeah. And what was your YouTube ad?
We had a pre-roll video that popped up. So let's say you were searching for, I don't know, The Strokes, Is This It? Before you watch that, you will see a 15-second pre-roll advertising our festival and showing our lineup. People click on that, they go to our website. Little pop-up banner ads that pop up in those videos as well. YouTube is such a popular destination for music fans, whether they want to listen to music for free or they want to watch a video. Or, you know, hear music for the first time. You know, it's a popular place on the internet. So we hit them and it's performed incredibly well for us. Incredibly well. Facebook used to perform better, but since Facebook changed their algorithms, it's harder to reach folks. You basically just have to pay more for it. So
I do see that of all the major social networks, Facebook still sends you the most organic traffic, more than Twitter, sure, more than Reddit, more than obviously Instagram, which sends hardly any traffic to anyone. Mm-hmm. You guys get a little bit from Last.fm, but again, mm-hmm, all of it is dwarfed by, sure, Facebook. What are you doing on Facebook that's been working so well?
Well, a lot of the organic stuff is people just sharing the lineup and sharing information about the event. You know, one of the things that people do when they go to an event or buy tickets is they tell their friends. They try to convince their friends to join them. You know, I'm going to this festival, come join me. And they put it out on their social media. And there is no better way to market an event than through word of mouth. If your friends who you trust, their opinion, and you know they like to do cool stuff, and they like to have fun, and they're talking about going to this event, you're going to trust them because you know them, and you know their style and their tastes. So many people we know that are our age and our main demo are on Facebook, and pretty much everybody's on Facebook. It's very easy to share things. It's very easy to see what your friends are into. It's just performed really, really well for us just because of that.
Your tickets are sold through Eventbrite. Is the Facebook integration part of Eventbrite? No, because Eventbrite Facebook integration sends people back to Eventbrite, not to your site, right?
That's correct. So all of our ads click through, or any of... Most people, most fans of the festival will just post the lineup and then a link to our website. And then they go to our website and they learn all about it and they can click there to buy tickets. All of our Facebook ads click through to our Eventbrite page where people can buy tickets. Now on that Eventbrite page, you can see our lineup, you can learn about the event, but it's pretty much just focused on selling tickets. You know, it's pretty simple, it's pretty straightforward, and it gets people to... you know, to see what we want them to do, which is buy tickets.
Your Eventbrite page looks great. Most people have the standard Eventbrite design. You guys really customized it. Eventbrite did it for you, though, right?
They actually didn't. But one of the reasons why we love Eventbrite is because they're so flexible. So we went to them and we said, we don't like the way your ticketing pages look, most respectfully. We want to put our graphic designer in touch with your web team and have... you guys figure out together how to make the site look as good as possible. Our web designer is a very good friend of ours. He's very knowledgeable in all sorts of code. So he was able to go into the Eventbrite backend and customize it so it looked as close to our website as possible, so it didn't really feel like you were leaving the site. You know, when you click on something and it takes you away from a site, you're instantly kind of taken aback and you want to leave there. So if we can make it look as much like our website as possible, you know, people are still thinking they're in the same place, people feel more comfortable, and we certainly want people to feel comfortable when they're spending money on tickets.
It's really well done. What's the designer's name?
Certain Studios.
Okay.
S-I-R-T-I-N. He's a very good friend of ours and incredibly good at what he does.
Really good. I mean, it's one thing to change a web design that you have full control over to the look that you have in mind. It's another thing to do that for someone else's site. One of the things that I've learned about Eventbrite from other organizers is they cut deals with events that they think add to their reputation, right?
So what do you mean cut deals?
They will reduce the price that they give you if you give them a little more promotion at an event that they are proud to be associated with.
I don't know. I feel like anybody, I mean, they're a growing company and they're trying to get more clients, right? And the ticketing business is very, very competitive,
yep.
Especially in the music space. So, you know, like any business and industry, you got to do what you got to do to get clients and to get business. Where they're lucky is that their platform is so strong and so good that they can cut that deal to get that client. And then once renewal comes up, the client doesn't think twice because they know how good it is.
I see.
So,
so you're saying you've got a deal, but you're not necessarily getting it in the future.
I think we'll get it in the future because we just generate so much revenue. I mean, if you generate a shitload of revenue, then they're making a shitload of money. So, you know, you have the leverage. Because if you go away, then they lose that. It really just comes down to leverage. And leverage is money. So,
Kevin Hart, who created that company, is one of the smartest entrepreneurs that I've ever interviewed. I don't even know if I could communicate in an interview how freaking bright the guy is.
I met him a few weeks ago, and I was intimidated by his demeanor because he just seemed like he was incredibly smart, and I was wondering what was going through his brain. I agree with you, he's incredibly smart.
So one of the cool things about living in San Francisco now is I get to meet the people who work for the people who I admire.
Sure.
To see like behind the scenes, are they full of it or do they really have more? Even behind the scenes, a guy is fantastic. He will do things like encourage his people to go help out local startups, partially because then they get to learn what's going on at those startups and
sure.
Bring the knowledge back to Eventbrite. And partially because I guess it creates great relationships with the startup community. There's no question that the guy has incredible access, and it makes sense that he would have invested in some of the biggest tech companies.
Sure.
Beyond Eventbrite. All right, I got to stop just praising him. It's us here today right now. To me, actually, speaking of revenue, you did over what? Over how much revenue did you do on the last concert?
Over 14 in ticket sales, and over 3 in other means.
$14 million in sales and ticket sales. No wonder Kevin Hart loves you guys. And merchandise and other, what else beyond merchandise is there?
You have concessions, you have sponsorship. You have merchandise, you have ATM fees, so on and so forth.
Are your investors, the ones that I talked about earlier, are they praising you the way that I just praised Kevin Hart, only 20 times more?
Well, what's interesting is that the very first year we borrowed money from friends and family on a short-term loan basis. So we are, after that first year, we made money because we also internally, my two partners and I, we also invested money. So we took the money that we made from year one to finance year two, took the money from year two to finance year three. So we don't have any investors. We
are
completely self-funded and self-owned.
And that investor, I know you had an investor who pulled out January, months before the first one launched. Is he,
correct.
Do you know him?
We do. He was a friend of ours who ran a website and, you know, he had some money and wanted to do a festival. He knew that we were trying to do a festival, and he agreed to be the financier for it, and then got cold feet and backed out. And, you know, at that point, we had already given our notices to our jobs, and we were backed into a corner, and we put together this business plan and went to friends and family and were able to scrounge up enough money to pull off year one. And we were scared shitless at the time, but thank goodness that happened, because if it didn't, you know, this amazing brand that we created wouldn't be entirely owned by us. It would be owned by someone else.
Really? Wow.
So yeah, we were lucky that the chips fell how they fell.
I had an investor in my first company who just wasn't interested, and I, for the longest time, would try to do really well so that he could regret it. It was one of the little motivations. I won't ask you.
No, we haven't spoken to him in a long time. He's very successful in his other ventures. I think he didn't know a lot about the music festival space, and once he learned a lot more from myself and my business partners, he got nervous about it. It's an insanely unique, interesting business and business model. And it's not for the faint of heart. You know, you can lose millions of dollars incredibly easily. And unless you really know your shit, you're not going to be successful. And for an outside person who doesn't know music to risk millions of dollars, you need to know a lot about what you're investing in. And he just didn't have that knowledge to feel comfortable.
What's the one thing, more than anything else, that you could attribute your success to?
Relationships and experience, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Either that or hard work. It was the relationships that we had that got us to where we are. It was the experience that we had over the years that gave us the knowledge to do what we're doing. And it was the consistent hard work that allowed us to execute everything that we wanted to execute. There are many sleepless nights, and we certainly don't work a traditional 9-to-5. You got to bust your ass if you want to be successful.
When I have sleepless nights, I worry about one thing, and the way that I could relax myself and stop worrying about it is to shift my focus from what I don't want to have happen, from that fear, from that worry, to what I do want to have happen. I'll just keep focusing on. Like, if I'm worried that today you're going to think I'm a jerk because of the email that I sent you yesterday, we should talk about that in the interview. I will come back to, in my mind, I'll go, you're going to learn something from this interview. You're going to learn something from this interview. Or you're going to make this so powerful that others are going to want to do the interview, or people are going to be amazed by it. But I'll try to shift my focus to one thing that will reassure me and remind me of where I'm going. What's your tactic for dealing with that?
It's a good question. Just staying focused on the task at hand and accomplishing the goal. Don't get tied up in the negatives. Focus on the positive and just figure out a way to make it work.
Keep shifting your focus back to the let's give an example. Eminem was scheduled to be at the event at one of the years. Which year was it?
Actually, this year, 2014.
2014. Yeah. And then what happened?
So we locked in Eminem in August, and in December, late December, he pulled out of the festival because he got an offer to do a stadium tour with Rihanna. It was a lot of money. It was a very big opportunity for him, and it was so big that he basically negged on the commitments that he made to us and to others. So he backed out in December, and we were without a major headliner. When we first heard the news, we were devastated and incredibly upset, and there are things we could have done, like legal action or other crazy things like that, but why do that? Why not just shift the focus on, well, you know what, there's other great headliners out there, let's go get another great headliner.
So whenever your mind would go to this, actually, where would your mind go when you start to worry about losing Eminem? What's the worry that you have? Is it this event is going to fail? We're going to lose money? Is it that we're going to lose face? It will not be as fun? What's the one thought that comes to your head that you almost have to wrestle out of there?
Well, the biggest problem then was that it was late December. And by late December the previous year, we had pretty much confirmed all of our headliners. So at that point, it was, shit, what other headliners are available in June? And are they good enough to sell 40,000 tickets? At that time, let me put these lights on again.
Sure. I must not be in a green building because I've got so many lights on me.
At that time, we just didn't know what was available. But, we knew that we had a brand and an event that was popular, very popular. And, you know, agents and managers, they want to put their bands on the festival. So we reached out to all the bands that were available. And luckily at that time, Outkast was, planning their return. And, you know, we were able to replace Eminem with Outkast. You gotta figure it out. You know, you gotta figure out what the best solution is.
To reassure yourself, do you think there are tons of other bands out there, or I figure things out? Is there a thought that goes to your head that allows you to regain your strength and get out there and find Outkast?
Honestly, you gotta kind of convince yourself. There's a good solution. Let's figure it out.
Gotcha.
And then you go talk to, you know, your business partners. You talk to other really smart people that you rely on, and you'll figure it out.
What about competition? You're small relative to giants like Live Nation.
Yes.
How do you deal with that?
It's not easy at all. New York City is the biggest, market in the world. And there are, big ones like Live Nation and AEG. And there are smaller ones that have a lot of power, like Bowery Presents. It's very tough because we are competing against them for, a lot of these bands New York City plays. It's gotten easier as time has gone by, as we've become more established. And again, we could put artists, let's just say you're a band that can sell 2,000 tickets in New York City in June, in the summertime. You could play a 2,000-person venue in June in the city in summertime. Or you could play the festival, where instead of playing in front of 2,000 people, you can play in front of 20,000 people. You can have 10 times as many people see your show, hear your music, learn about you. And it's become not necessarily a no-brainer, but a much more attractive play than playing these other smaller rooms. So it's gotten easier over time. Thankfully, there's not that much festival competition in the New York City market, because there's not many places to do it, and because we've really left our mark as the New York City event. But it's, competition is something that it always rears its head. And we lose some bands to promoters, especially headliners, when companies like Live Nation can, own a band's entire tour and control exactly where they go. We try to stay focused and plan way far ahead, and convince the agent and the manager that we are a better opportunity than elsewhere.
Year two sales were low, and you were thinking maybe we're going to lose money. How did you pull out of that?
So our year two sales were slower than we anticipated, and we didn't really know. We had to huddle up internally. We had to talk to our trusted friends and inner circle about, are we going to need bridge financing? Are we going to lose money? Are we going to need to raise money to do year three? How is it all going to work? And we came up with a lot of different scenarios and plans for, different amounts of losses and for break-evens and whatnot. And we came up with a lot of different plans. And so we knew going into it exactly what we would need to do, depending upon where sales were at. Thankfully, we broke even that year, and we had made money from year one to ride us into year three. But it was such a learning process and really a beneficial one, trying to figure out, at that time, we didn't really know what bridge financing was. We didn't know the intricacies of short-term loans and, what the mandatory interest level was. Really, because in year one, we borrowed from friends and family, and those folks didn't really care if we lost the money, to be frank. In year two, the folks that we talked to, cared a little bit more. It was tough, but it was a really good experience. And a lot of times it's when you're backed into a corner and you have to address tough subjects that you learn the most.
In the pre-interview with our producer, April asked you if you could teach a class to other entrepreneurs, what would it be about? And that's our way of trying to get at what lesson you've learned that's so powerful that you'd want to pass it on to other people. We usually get things that are much more common than what you gave, which is taking calculated risks. How do you do it? How do you take calculated risks in an industry like this?
Well, I I don't read as often as I should, but you know, I've read some marketing books, and a lot of them say, you know, don't be afraid to fail and don't be afraid to take risks. I totally agree with that, but you know, you have to make sure you're taking a calculated risk. You have to look at all of the options and all of the possible outcomes and make sure that it really makes sense. In this industry, with the amount of competition there is and with the high risk, high reward stakes, you really have to make sure that, you know, everything is lined up so that you can maximize your probability for making money. It's really not easy, but making sure that you know, you can book certain bands, that you know you're going to sell a certain amount of tickets, making sure that your expenses are a certain amount and not going to go over, making sure that you have a brand that can grow, making sure that the economy is in the right place, so demand is there. You really have to analyze all aspects of the business and the business model and make sure that everything's in line so you can make a calculated risk as opposed to just taking a risk. Because too many people in this industry take risks and lose millions and either go bankrupt or go into hiding.
I've seen the people who go into hiding. It's even making financial models. That is part of the answer to running a cool concert.
Absolutely. I mean, ultimately, it comes down, I mean, every business comes down to the numbers, you know. You're not, your business isn't going to survive if you don't have the dollars in the bank and you don't produce those numbers. So it's the least sexy part of what we do, but it's, you know, one of the most important.
Speaking of numbers, how old were you when you became a millionaire because of this business?
That's a tough question. Last year.
Last year.
Yeah.
And did you do anything that would allow you to celebrate, acknowledge it, anything like that?
No.
No, it was just another number and you just moved on.
No, I have a goal of the amount of money I want to make in my life. So once I hit that goal, maybe I'll do something really fun. But until then, just stay focused.
And, what's the number?
Keep doing it. $10
million. $10 million. Why 10?
You know what? I have no idea.
It just came up, right?
It's just a number in my head that if I had $10 million in the bank, I would feel really fucking good.
I see. You have $1 million. I don't know if you read the New York Times article, but monocles now are the rage. I feel like you've earned it. Would you buy a monocle? You can get it.
I'd buy a monocle if I had a hat and could grow a mustache like the Monopoly guy.
Well, maybe the second you have to earn. Maybe save the hat for the $5 million and the mustache.
One step at a time.
You know, I don't know if you saw it, but there was this viral video going around about how, I guess it was a Fox affiliate that accidentally showed a penis on the screen because they were showing. You saw that, right?
I saw that yesterday. My lady friend said that to me.
Did you see what they did right after they came on?
The reaction?
Yeah.
It was amazing.
It was like, and then they carried on like nothing happened. I hate that. I feel like they're doing a show, you know, and they might as well just be talking heads at that point. I want to be real, and that's why I asked you about money, and that's why I think I should acknowledge even the mistake that I made yesterday. And instead of it coming for me, since you were on the other end of it, how did it come across to you? What did you experience? We should be open about this.
About the email that you sent?
The email that I sent and the mistake that I made, and I want to apologize publicly, but I feel like I should set up for the audience to understand what I'm apologizing for.
Well, to be honest with you, I didn't know that you know, your company and website and the series was just focused on tech. I had no idea. So when you mentioned to me that it was just focused on tech and my business didn't really qualify, it just surprised me. But I was curious, you know, how, if my business wasn't tech, how we qualified to be even reached out to. So that's why I asked that question. But, you know, I didn't really think anything of it. It was just it sparked some curiosity.
And the email that you sent back, that you didn't just say, okay, you said, well, then how did I even get this far, made me go back and think, well, here's what happened. I was sitting to do 5 interviews yesterday, and 2 of those interviews that I was about to record were with people who just clearly didn't fit. And I went back, and thankfully our process is so detailed that I can see where the mistakes were made and we can go back and correct it. So that made me think, you know what, if I had 5 interviews to record yesterday and 2 of them weren't right, let's look at tomorrow. And then I saw you and I said, oh, what is this? Now we're doing, what was the name of the company? I don't know the name of your company except through our site. It's
Founders Entertainment.
Founders Entertainment. So I don't know that. Mm-hmm. So I said, Founder, something's broken here. I don't want Tom to have to sit here on Wednesday to record and then be told, wait, this is not a good fit. So I quickly emailed you to avoid a problem. And I explained, I like the story, but it's just not going to be a good fit. And then you emailed me back and you said, wait, then how did I even get this far? And thankfully, like I said, I was starting to say, I went back and I saw every stage of the decision-making process right up to the specific email that I got that got me so excited that we could potentially even have you on that I said, we got to make it work. And then I realized, oh, governors. And I said, maybe I should not that I was drunk, but like sober up as in just my head was a little woozy from doing from sitting for five interviews. Maybe I need to make sure that that I'm not making a mistake again before emailing him. And I said, screw it. I got to email Tom and I apologize. And thankfully you're willing to come back on here.
Of course.
It's, you know what? Part of what we do here is just fun conversations with entrepreneurs. Part of it is, I mean, the behind the scenes stuff is very detailed. It's very structured because otherwise I go mad trying to find people. Do you have a structure too for finding performers, for making sure they're the right fit and so on?
Yeah, I mean, as I mentioned earlier, we're huge music fans, so we know pretty much off the top of our heads how many tickets different bands are worth in different markets, especially this one. So we know when a band can come here, if they're going to sell 10,000 tickets or 5,000 tickets or 500 tickets. So, you know, we have a talent grid that, you know, lays out the headliners and the second to close and the third to close and the first bands up. And we have a good gauge of, you know, how many bands or how many tickets each of those slotted acts should be able to sell. And then we just kind of mix and match from there, see who's available that fits in that category, make them an offer, and hopefully they confirm and we slot them in there.
You know, I wouldn't have expected so much data to go into this. I see your festival. It's just such a fun event. I see you're wearing a hoodie. You're just kind of relaxed over there. And to me, if we hadn't had this deep conversation, I would have thought, well, he just knows music, you know, what's the big deal? You just find a few acts and you put them together and life works out. But it is so much more of a business than I would have expected. I would have thought all art, hardly any business.
Well, isn't that any industry? You know, you kind of, from an outsider's perspective, you kind of just see the easy fun part. And then, you know, it's the behind the scenes stuff that most people don't think about. That it's where it gets really the most complex. But it's why we do what we do, right? We want to have the fun and have great music and have a great time and see some special entertainment. It's just the only way to get there is to do the nitty gritty and all the behind the scenes stuff.
Let me say this to my audience. I know that the fun interviews are the ones with a big, frankly, this interview is fun. The ones with the bigger names you gravitate to even more, the ones that have anything to do with systems or any like that, people don't seem to go to. Be one of the few people who understand the value of this, of creating systems, of modeling your success and so on. And what I'm trying to say is when you're searching for interviews on Mixergy, search for the ones about how to organize your business in a way that makes sense, in a way that's professional. Let me give you a suggestion. Instead of talking about the topic, I'll give you a specific suggestion. Listen to my interview with Sam Carpenter about his book, Work the System. He is a guy who takes complicated businesses and systemizes them in a way that they actually will function, that they will grow, so that he can hire people who manage each part of the business so that it will grow without him. In a responsible way, Sam Carpenter is one of several interviews that I've done on Mixergy and courses about systems. I really urge you to go and listen to that. Be one of the few people who appreciate that it may not sound sexy, but it'll lead to sexy results. It's all available for you on Mixergy. Hit the search bar and go look for Sam Carpenter. And one of the things that I learned by looking at our system is Scott Wells is the guy who suggested that we interview you. Do you know Scott?
The name rings a bell. Where exactly from? I cannot tell.
Okay, I thought maybe he was like a close personal friend of yours, but he's someone who is so passionate about you and your work that he said, you have to go check it out. And of course I said yes. Final question is this. When I asked you what you were excited about doing this interview, you said, we are at the forefront of, I wrote this exactly, we are at the forefront of cool shit. What does this mean and what does this have to do with the tech community?
You know, we like to think of ourselves of curators of cool shit, whether that's really cool music and live music, whether that's really delicious, awesome food, whether that's really great partners that are bringing really cool, unique things to the table. Right now in the technology space, there is so much development and so much movement, and companies are offering so many different things that better our lives. We really make an effort to try to work with those companies to expose our consumers and our patrons to that technology, whether it's a new app company or a new phone or a new whatever wireless sound system. We want to work with companies that do really cool, unique stuff that our patrons can benefit from. We try to restrict all of our sponsors to ones that have products where our consumers can benefit, both at the festival and at home. So, you know, with a company like yours and a website like yours that work with and chat with technology companies from around the world that are creating technologies that ideally make our lives easier, make our lives better, you know, we want that. We want a feature technology that can do that. We want to educate our audience not only on good music that they've never heard of or good food that they've never tried, but also good technology that they never even knew existed that once they do know exists can make their lives easier and better. So,
what's a good way for people to follow up with you to say thank you for doing this interview, to say, hey, I love what you said about being at the forefront of cool shit, and hey, Andrew is a bit of a jerk, don't let his systems get in the way of conversations. Is there a way for people to follow up with you?
Yeah, just shoot me an email. It's tom@foundersent.com.
All right. And I'm also going to suggest anyone who's heard this interview all the way through, now go back and take a look at the website with a fresh new understanding of the business. If you go to governorsballmusicfestival.com, I'll give it to you again, governorsballmusicfestival.com. Now, unlike most people who click at the buy tickets button and don't understand all the stuff that goes on behind the scenes to creating that page, you're going to look at it in a whole different way. You're going to recognize the domain name at the top. You're going to recognize the art that went into it. You're going to recognize how they even have the share buttons in there in a way that you might not have noticed or maybe just brushed past in the past. Don't just look at the site. Really, really look at the site. Tom, thank you so much for doing this interview.
Pleasure. Thanks for reaching out.
You bet. Thank you all for being a part of this. Goodbye.